Welcome to the RSP Cast Quick Game. This is Matt Waldman, and I am here with Mark Schofield, the post-Senior Bowl, pre-Super Bowl edition, where we are going to answer a number of questions in rapid-fire succession with a two-minute time limit and a four-minute time limit. I think this is going to be our off-season time schedule when we do this, Mark. So, you know, it was good to see you last week at the Senior Bowl.
Great to see you, man. And we usually don't get a chance to spend as much time as we did together. Usually it's like we breeze past each other. There are so many time commitments, but we get a chance to watch some practice together. We got a couple meals together. I cherished every minute of it. I cherish our friendship. It was just a great time down in Mobile. And I'm excited to be healthy again. And I know we're going to dive into this, but I just want to say I ate two vegetables down in Mobile. Some Man. Green beans that were like slathered in butter and on top of a cowboy ribeye and fried okra. So
does a double portion of greens and butter soup, you know, count as a vegetable? I don't know.
Because you know? What did you have with that? That was at Saucy Q's when we went there for lunch on Thursday. And it wasn't like you ordered a side salad with it.
No, I think it was like five chicken wings right. With like, you know, smoked chicken wings, which is the light end of that menu.
Yes. That's a tough menu. Although none of us pulled the Kyle Krabs from a couple of years ago when he tried the Big Pig Challenge, which is like 5 pounds of like pulled pork, all these buns, coleslaw. And he struggled, but he got it done in 45 minutes to his credit.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I remember I didn't know he did, but the last time I saw him, he did. He looked like he had eaten about 2/3 of it and was like, didn't look like he was going to die yet. So that was good.
No, he struggled through it. People struggle through Senior Bowl week in a variety of ways. And sometimes it's food related more than anything else.
Right. So here we go. Let's get into it then. Before we get to the Senior Bowl, though, let's talk a little bit about this game coming up in the NFL. So what must San Francisco do to have a competitive game against the Chiefs?
Yeah, and it's strange, Matt, how like narratives are starting to form about this Super Bowl. And you and I and some others talked about this game a little bit while we were down in Mobile. And it seems like the emerging consensus, at least amongst us chuckleheads, is San Francisco needs like to play not a perfect game, but a pretty close to perfect game. And they have one path to win, whereas Kansas City has a couple of different ways they can do it. And I think for San Francisco, they need to control the ball somewhat. They need to keep Patrick Mahomes on the sideline as much as they can. We know Mahomes and company can score quickly. And they need to get Mahomes under pressure and show him some things that, you know, he's probably seen before, but maybe wasn't expecting from them. Robert Saleh has to do some different things that, you know, Andy Reid and company aren't expecting. And so I think Garoppolo needs to play, you know, turnover-free football. I think their defense needs to confuse Patrick Mahomes a little bit at times and show him some different looks. And they need to manage the clock as much as they can and keep Patrick Mahomes on the sideline. That's sort of their pathway to victory. Can they do it? Absolutely. Look, they're a great football team, a very good defense. They can throw the ball better than I think people are giving them credit for. We saw what they could do in the running game, you know, in the NFC Championship game. But they're going to have to play a pretty darn near perfect game to win this one, I think.
Yeah, and I think that probably one of the things that they're going to have to do in order to play that perfect game is they're going to have to get off to a really fast start and hope that the Chiefs get off to a super slow start, like a Bill O'Brien versus, you know, Houston Texans slow start, and that it's something where, you know, the Chiefs make mistakes, you know, whether it's their running game fumbling the football or Mahomes getting a little too aggressive on a particular play or the offensive line maybe eating something that's laced with LSD. I don't know. Something's going to have to happen for this Chiefs team to really start slow and give the 49ers an opportunity to run the football, you know, pretty much from the second quarter on and have success against that. Because, again, you know, the Chiefs are not a good rush defense. That's just not their thing. But they didn't add to their defense, you know, in that way to do that. They fortified their secondary because they know that they're going to be playing with leads more often than not. So if you can get the early lead and then you can sustain it with a really strong ground attack, I think that if you can keep the Chiefs in catch-up mode and you can continue to have longer drives, then you could maybe win a game that's, you know, something to the effect of 27-21, 28-21, 28-24, something of that nature, where you are up on a big lead, maybe a, you know, a 17-0 lead or something of that nature early on. And then you can, you know, you can shorten the game. And I think that that's probably what needs to happen, if you ask me, just because this team, I think the passing game is better than people talk about for San Francisco, but the Chiefs, pass defense is also better than what we're talking about oftentimes too. Yeah. So it's going to need to, we're going to need to, you know, get off to a big lead here. So what about the Chiefs? What do they have to do to stay competitive in this matchup?
You know, I think they're going to need to get some stops with their run defense. Like you mentioned, look, they bolstered their secondary because they anticipated playing with leads and other teams trying to throw to catch up. But I think this is a game where if we take that first part that we talked about, where we assume San Francisco is going to want to try to run the ball a bit, try to keep Mahomes on the sideline, you're going to need to get some run stops in this game. And that sort of falls on the Chiefs' run defense. I think, you know, they do have more pathways to win. They can get down and still win because they can score in a flash. They can, you know, get the ball, go right down the field and score, get a stop on defense, and suddenly it's 14-0 in the blink of an eye, and this game seems like it might spiral out of control. So they've got a number of different ways they can win. But I think, you know, the one thing they'll need to do that maybe they haven't done consistently this year is get some run stops, is to sort of slow down that game and put it more into Jimmy Garoppolo's hands. Not like Garoppolo's a bad quarterback, but I'm sure if you know, dragged Kyle Shanahan out to Veets and asked him after a couple of drinks, you know, what's your best way to win this game? He's going to tell you it's that running game. So get some run stops. I think that's what Kansas City needs to do, perhaps more than some of the other things people are talking about, to win this game on Sunday.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, and that obviously means that you're counting on, you know, San Francisco being able to keep it close early enough that they are going to be able to run the football. And I think that that's, you know, that's a sensible thought, considering the fact that San Francisco does have a good defense overall. I'm going to go with the route that, you know, though I'm probably going to play into the more, you know, common idea, which is I think they just need to, they need to play their brand of offense and yeah, be able to hit that early. And I think if they do that early, I think that pretty much not only will it be, you know, the thing that they'll probably have to do after that is, you know, get pressure on Jimmy Garoppolo up the middle. I think if Chris Jones can have the type of game that he's capable of having, he can be the reason that this team is pretty much shut down after an early lead. If they can, you know, if the Chiefs offense can get an early lead there. So, I mean, really more than anything, I think you need to see consistent play out of players who the 49ers are going to try and force the Chiefs to throw the ball to, which are going to be DeMarcus Robinson and Sammy Watkins. I think that if those guys don't drop the ball early, if they, you know, if they play clean football early and force the 49ers to account for more than just Hill and Kelsey, you know, early on, I think that this can be a game where, you know, the Chiefs can have it in hand offensively in terms of how they get off to a quick start. But if both of those guys fail to convert on easier opportunities that I think the defense will afford them, then I think that we're going to be in for a more interesting game in terms of something being close and maybe the 49ers be able to execute their game plan that they hope to limit the Chiefs' offense.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see. So what do you think is the game script that's most likely to unfold?
I mean, I think the most likely scenario is that this is a close game where Kansas City pulls ahead in the second half, but it's sort of that 10-point kind of feel to it. I don't think the most likely scenario is a Kansas City blowout. There's certainly that potential. But I do think that San Francisco is good enough offensively and defensively, certainly, to keep this game close into the second half. I do think that with the weapons Patrick Mahomes has at his disposal and the ability for that offense to just score in the blink of an eye, you know, there's a chance for them to pull away just a little bit. And so, you know, looking at this game, I know the line's about 1.5 or so. I do like Kansas City to cover in this one. And I do think they'll sort of pull away at the end. Maybe they force a turnover and get another quick score or something like that. I think that's the most likely scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about that, and I agree with you. I do think Kansas City ends up winning this game by somewhere between 10 to 13 points, but I think it's because they pull away later in the game where it's like it looks a lot closer, or it doesn't look as close as it actually was for most of the game. So what do you think is the least likely game script?
I mean, I think least likely is probably a San Francisco blowout, right? Like if we wake up Monday morning and it was like 35-10 San Francisco, I think a lot of people are going to be wondering why, you know, Robert Saleh isn't a head coach for the upcoming season. Because if it's a, you know, San Francisco blowout, they're going to need their defense to do something that we haven't seen a lot of teams do to Kansas City and Patrick Mahomes. And that's, you know, shut them down. And I don't think people are expecting that at all. And I don't think it's likely to happen at all.
Yeah, I think it's the least likely. The only thing that may be less likely is us to have a reverse situation with, say, the Texans and the Chiefs playoff game, where the Chiefs jump off to a big lead and then the 49ers come roaring back and overtake them and blow them out. That would be the least likely to be, but it's in the same category as what you just described. So, you know, but those would be the two least likely scenarios for sure. So, you know, let's move on from the Super Bowl to the Senior Bowl. I mean, we just got back from it, as we just talked about. What did you find most compelling from the practices this week?
Yeah, you know, there are a number of different ways you could take this. You could talk a little bit, like, philosophically about how the two teams sort of structure their practices. And part of me does wonder if Matt Patricia heard a little bit of blowback from people in and around the league after his Tuesday practice, where it seemed like that North team stretched, I think, five or six different times. And a lot of people in the stands, myself included, were wondering, okay, well, what am I going to write tonight about stretching? Like, I can't do anything with this, because it seemed like their practices sort of picked up over the next 2 days in tempo and pace and what they were asked to do. And so, you know, it was interesting to see that versus, you know, Zach Taylor. A lot of the reps in that, you know, Tuesday practice seemed like they were slow and taking some time, but they did a lot of different things. So it's always interesting to see, you know, how these teams construct their practices. I don't think anything will compared to what we saw from Jacksonville a couple of years ago, where it seemed like all they did was practice special teams. And it's like, I guess if you're going to be punting 15 times a game, like, you got to get ready for it. So, you know, it's interesting to see how the teams structure their practices. I was very fascinated, I think, by the tight ends. And part of that might be the Patriots background and, you know, doing some work for Pat's Pulpit and doing some Patriots shows while I was down there and the focus on tight ends. But I was transfixed by Adam Trautman. I think he's a fantastic tight end prospect. I'm very intrigued by Steven Sullivan, who I think, while he may not have been able to carve out a role for himself at LSU, given the fact they ran so much 11 personnel, the tight end that they had on the roster is Thaddeus Moss, who's probably going to get drafted pretty early, obviously son of Randy, and they had some great receivers. So you're not going to run 12 just to get him on the field and take some of your great receivers off the field. But I think for an NFL team that's going to run a lot of 12 personnel, like, say, Chicago, they want to run 12. New England obviously likes to run 12. Some other teams, Indianapolis uses a lot of multiple tight end sets. He's a fantastic matchup piece because he's the guy that you can spread out, can use his size against corners and his background as a wide receiver, but you move him inside, he can use his athleticism and his background as a wide receiver to run away from linebackers and safeties. I think he's a fascinating matchup piece in the NFL, so I was very compelled by him. And finally, Ben Bartsch, the D3 kid. You know, a D3 kid like me is going to show some love to a D3 kid. At times, he looked like the best tackle down there. And I think he made himself a ton of money. Is a fascinating story. That's some of the stuff that I was interested in while we were down in Mobile. But what about you?
Yeah, I certainly liked Steven Sullivan. I thought that he looked fantastic in terms of being able to run routes, but he was also a pretty darn good blocker, at least in the drills that they showed up. So he looked like one of the best tight ends on the field. I actually thought that he was one of the two to three best tight ends out of that group. And so it was really nice to see, you know, the kind of route runner he was and the kind of burst that he had, and the explosion that he had really as a route runner, which was something we didn't really see a lot of from Jarrett Pickney, who came into this, you know, this year as the top tight end prospect.
Yeah.
And I think that he showed that he was a guy that can get open within 10 to 15 yards of the line of scrimmage, but that's about it. You know, unless it's a zone, look or a misdirection look where he's running wide open, you're not going to see him catch a lot of deep balls as a result of that. And then I would say, you know, beyond the tight end, you know, scope of things, though, I'll mention also Bryson Hopkins, I thought was a very good route runner, and looked good there too. But I would say that when you talk about, you know, the tight ends or the running backs right now, I mean, I would say Darius Anderson was interesting to me coming in, but Darius Anderson, Keyshawn, you know, I'm trying to think of Keyshawn Vaughn, and then Eno Benjamin, all three were lighter than I expected them to be, but I thought that Benjamin showed the kind of vision in selected runs that kind of stood up to what he shows as a runner, you know, on film. I would say the same thing with Anderson. He looked really good. It was too bad that Vaughn got hurt, but I think Anderson's interesting to me because I think he plays heavier than his weight, kind of the way that Clinton Portis played heavier than his weight or Jamal Charles played heavier than his weight. I don't know if he's either of those two guys, but I think he belongs in that, you know, make and model of running back types, you know, the low end of that make and model of running back types who's currently playing right now would be a guy like Justin Jackson. You know, the Chargers running back who has offered some compelling looks when he gets into the game. And I think that Anderson is along those lines. But the guy that most surprised me probably out of all of them, you know, in terms of that whole weight being different than what was listed, was Juwan Jennings, a player that I really liked heading into the Senior Bowl and who I was making a lot of Brandon Marshall, Anquan Boldin comps. But, you know, it was funny because even though he had a week where, you know, he had a week where that, you know, he had a good week overall, I would say, but he was probably dealt the hand where defenders early on were like, we have to manhandle him. Like the whole week I watched, he complained a fair bit about getting manhandled, but I didn't see another receiver get manhandled like he did. And it wasn't even because he couldn't get separation, because he often did. It was he'd get early separation or he'd work to get late separation. And then the defender realizing he was going to get beat would wrap him up, you know, and play pretty tight. And what I did notice is that it might have changed his, you know, his profile might have changed from Brandon Marshall, Anquan Boldin, but it went more to Hines Ward, Jarvis Landry. And I don't think that's too bad either.
No, that's not too shabby.
Yeah. So those are the guys that were notable to me. Okay, so how about this? Somebody who definitely wasn't at the Senior Bowl, but was certainly invited, but decided to turn it down, is Joe Burrow. And, you know, if you go to Twitter and you look around at the analysis that's there, you'll probably see occasionally people talking about this, but, and I haven't talked about it an awful lot, but I've touched upon it as well. And that's it. Joe Burrow, and what do you think of his arm strength? I mean, does he have the velocity to play in the NFL? How do you gauge it in terms of how would you describe it? And do you think that there's a fit issue in terms of, you know, who he would best fit with or wouldn't fit with based on that arm strength? And if so, what are those fits?
Yeah, and I think that when it comes to Burrow and arm strength, I often try to get in the mind of Bruce Arians when he's putting together his quarterback board. And when it comes to the arm strength question, and we know the offense that Bruce Arians likes to run, the more downfield vertical passing game. And would it surprise me if it ever comes out, you know, his board that Joe Burrow wasn't QB1 for him? No, it wouldn't surprise me at all. Because when you watch Burrow on film, there are areas where you see the velocity start to trail off. You see the ball start to dip. You see him have to rely on more touch. And some of those boundary throws, you know, 15 yards down the field, outside the numbers, maybe even outside the hash a little bit, and then more deeper stuff downfield if you want to throw some of those seam routes, you know, with put those on a bit more of a line. You know, that's areas of the field where Burrow starts to struggle a little bit. And that's an area of the field where, for example, guys like Justin Herbert and Jordan Love and Jacob Eason probably don't have similar issues. And so there is that aspect to Joe Burrow that isn't there right now. It's not to say that it can't get there. You know, you can certainly increase velocity over the course of your NFL career. You know, if you look back at where Tom Brady was and where he was just a couple of years ago and versus where he was when he started in the league, he certainly was somebody that, you know, you get into that sort of NFL strength and conditioning program, or maybe you start your own TB12 method, you can increase velocity by, you know, a number of means. And so it's not, you know, a foreclosed opportunity for Joe Burrow. But I do think it does tie into his initial best scheme fit. And that does bring us back to Cincinnati. I do think with what Cincinnati wants to do in terms of the spacing concepts, the route concepts, the quick game type stuff that, you know, they're going to pull over, that they have pulled over from, you know, when Zach Taylor was under Sean McVay, with some shot play stuff downfield, which Joe Burrow can certainly throw. I think that is an ideal fit for him. But if you think about other quarterbacks or other quarterback coaches around the league where he might not fit best, you know, Tampa Bay would be one. A vertical passing game might be that kind of situation. If the New York Giants were looking for a quarterback at four, having hired just hired Jason Garrett, you expect them to be more of a Coryell type offense. I don't think Burrow would be the best fit for them. So it might be a bit of a fit issue early on. I think his arm is fine to do what 90% of what NFL teams ask their quarterbacks to do. And I wouldn't dissuade me at all from drafting him first overall.
There you go. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the arm strength is definitely an issue. And I think that, but I don't think it's something that's going to be a deal breaker for him being a good quarterback in the right. NFL. But I think that it could be a deal breaker for certain teams and for certain looks. Certainly, you know, one of the things that can be an issue with him is velocity when he's on the move, not moving forward, but maybe moving to his right or left, right, and having to deliver it on a line. So, you know, certain types of play action looks and bootlegs may not be his bag if you're asking him to make the higher velocity type of throws. But again, you know, this is the area where we have to look at the Deshaun Watsons of the world, the Lamar Jacksons of the world, and understand that if you can use your legs, if you can throw for distance, if you can throw with touch, and you can read defenses and you can avoid pressure, you know, having a cannon of an arm is not a prerequisite for a lot of offenses. And I think that we can go as far back as, you know, the offenses that the McVays of the world, you know, kind of were influenced by. And you can go back to, you know, John Gruden. And you look at John Gruden and what he did with his brand of West Coast offense, and he had a guy by the name of Rich Gannon who was league MVP who didn't really have much of an arm in terms of being able to throw the ball even for distance beyond more than about 35 yards with accuracy on a consistent basis. And he certainly played at a high level and was able to take his team to a Super Bowl. And I think that Joe Burrow, when you look at his game on a, you know, a level of on a certain scale, it's very similar to Rich Gannon when it comes to just like the strengths, the physical strengths and weaknesses, and some of the conceptual strengths and weaknesses of his game. So if he can put it all together, I think that he could have a career that's very similar to what Rich Gannon was able to provide at his height. You know, and certainly Andy Dalton doesn't have a great arm either. Mm-hmm. So you could look at him as maybe as a higher, you know, maybe a more promising type of Andy Dalton-esque type of player. So I would agree with you about, you know, where he fits and where he doesn't fit. And I think that you're looking at a guy who still is a very strong NFL prospect in this year's class.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are some, let's move on a little bit and talk a little bit about just writing in general, you know, writing about football. We touched on that in our last podcast, which, you know, appreciate the feedback that everybody gave us regarding that. So, you know, moving a little bit more into that realm, you know, are there any physical considerations for writing in terms of doing this for a living? Because there are a lot of people who, you know, they have desk jobs or they have jobs where they are, that are considered desk jobs, and then they start writing, or they've had physical jobs and they start writing. And after they've been tied to a desk for a while doing this, they have some realizations that that are worthwhile sharing. Do you have any that you would like to add to that list?
Yeah, I do. And I think there are physical considerations that go into this. And, you know, maybe I'll burn a timeout here just to be safe because I might run long. And I know we're going to talk about the concept of the grind in a couple of questions here. But in season from, say, August to January, this is a difficult grind. You know, if you're somebody like me where you're writing for 6, 7, 8, 10 different places, sometimes I forget, you know, you're basically, you know, watching film, doing shows and writing almost every spare moment. And I should probably preface what I should have prefaced by, you know, I'm not the most athletic person still, you know, I probably wasn't to begin with. That's why I was just a Division III QB. But I do like to work out still. And I try to work out, lift weights 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. I'm even somewhat of a semi-competitive power lifter, believe it or not. If you look up Maryland 100% Raw, I am still the state record holder in the strict curl in my age and weight class. I competed in one power lifting event, set a record because I thought I could do it, and I went out and did it. And I did that in October of 2018, because I knew I would have to keep working out. And so I partly did that to keep myself going to the gym, because otherwise, like this past season, I just stopped going to the gym. I didn't have time. So started in September. I just didn't see the gym until the season ended, you know, right after the holiday. So I got back in, you know, in January. And so there's a potential to fall into unhealthy traps. And the other thing to keep in mind is that you will sometimes be working odd, strange hours. You might find yourself having to do shows late into the night. If you're doing shows or covering a team, they play on Monday night and then you got to get a show done. You're staggered up to bed at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. And when that alarm goes off at 7 a.m. and your day starts, you're doing it all over again. So there's a lack of sleep. There's a lack of athletic activity and exercising. There are diet things that go into this. Like, you know, I don't have the metabolism I did when I was 23, you know, being 43 now. And so if I just, you know, skip a meal or skip breakfast because I have to get something done, and then I'm hungry at lunchtime and I eat something quick, and it's usually going to be of the, like, you know, I'll just run out and grab something from Burger King. Like, that stuff adds up too. And so you have to sort of find ways to take care of yourself. Because if we've learned anything from whether it's this weekend or other events in the world, life is short, and you get, you know, you can have a couple of different jobs, a couple of different whatever in life, but you get one body and you have to do what you can to take care of it. And, you know, sometimes, you know, and that's in season, it could be tough to do that. Now that we're through the grind of the regular season and the playoffs, it's easier. Able to go to the gym and do those kinds of things and, you know, make myself breakfast and lunch and all that kind of stuff. But in season, it's tough. And so for those of us in this industry, I'd stress, if you can, find a way to carve out some time, even if it's just 30 minutes, to get up and take a walk around the neighborhood or wherever you work, and make sure you do it. Because the last thing you want is to be like a friend of mine who also a work at home guy, but not in the football industry, but he was on a family cruise over the holidays and the dude had a heart attack at like 35. He's fine. He's completely healthy, but you don't want to be like that. There's a way to avoid it. Find a way to carve out some time to take care of yourself, because you can have different careers. You can have different jobs. You can have different gigs. You get one body.
Great advice. You know, certainly great advice. I'll take a time out on this one as well. And I think that, you know, it does begin with what your station is when you're starting out doing this. If you're doing multiple jobs and you're juggling multiple things, then you're going to be at the beck and call of everyone. And it also means that you're also trying to vie for the level of attention where any podcast opportunity that comes up that's viable, you don't want to really turn down. So that does mean that you're going to have to, you know, carving out time can be more difficult on that level. But there's also a point where you transition where maybe you know, I'm at a point where I went from that to where I kind of have two full-time gigs now, but I'm not you know, scrapping in terms of the way Mark is, in terms of doing multiple different things. I'd call it scuffling on that level, you know, because it's a lot of, you know, you're living the freelancer life on a level that's a little different, where I'm living kind of a business owner life with a steady gig also at Football Guys. But on that level, it's like, there was a transition with that where I had to learn to turn things down. I had to learn to go, I can't take every single thing that's going to come along, because I do need some sleep. I do need to get some sort of regularity in my life. And part of that too, is that when you are in a gig that you're sitting, you know, spending a lot of time sitting, and we both have had more physical gigs. I've certainly had more physical jobs where I'm at least standing half to most of my day. And when you're doing that, your metabolism is going to stay high. But, you know, being 49 and going on 50, you know, it's, you know, your metabolism slows down much more, you know, so it is, you know, even if you're eating well, you need to be able to find a way to exercise. And sometimes doing exercises can be something as routine as, yeah, maybe you don't go to the gym, but maybe you, for me, I have like a home workout area across from my office, and I'll try and, you know, if I don't get a full session in throughout every day, or at least 5 days a week, what I will try to do now is at least take little breaks where it's like, okay, I'm going to go do a set of pushups. Now I'm going to go do a set of squats, you know, and then 30 minutes later, I'm going to do work on, you know, working with a bucket on grip exercises with a bucket of sand. And this, you know, the next 15 minutes, I'm going to do this and do increments of that throughout the day. That can be helpful in terms of just still being able to have some level of activity, you know, and getting some of that exercise in, even if it's not all the way through. I find my season, my regular season, is much easier in terms of a pattern to keep, to continue working out. It gets harder for me actually after the season, when I get sucked into wanting, you know, doing this book, and then it's, you know, my schedule goes round the clock in a weird sort of way where I find myself feeling like I'm taking a series of naps between work, as opposed to actually, you know, going to bed at a certain time, getting up at a certain time, working out, and then going to work. And, you know, my summer and fall feels much more like a regular shift type of work. Whereas, you know, my January through June probably feels much odder. And that's the one thing I'm trying to get a control over this year, is it seems like every year I get to about March and then like everything goes by the wayside. And then the last thing that I will mention, and I know that I'm probably going to go long on this one, is, you know, I've been writing I've been writing at multiple gigs or multiple full-time type of situations for at least 15 years now. And I've never had any kind of repetitive stress issue or carpal tunnel issue until about a month ago. And that was very scary for someone in my business to deal with that. And I think I finally gotten it kind of worked out here, you know, just with addition, you know, and part of it was because I moved and my normal desk wasn't using, and I was using a different setup. And, you know, until I kind of build out what my office is going to be like in our house in a couple of years, hopefully. But I got it somewhere along the line. And I would just say to those of you, make sure you look into ergonomic resources. Make sure that the moment you start feeling any pain in like your shoulders or your elbows or your wrists, that you stop what you're doing and take some time off. If you have to say you're sick and miss something, do that, because you don't want to, you want to catch that early, and you want to figure out how to fix it as soon as possible to make sure that your posture's right, make sure that you know you're sitting, you know, in a way that you need to, so that when you're spending long hours doing what you're doing, that you don't compound the situation. And the next thing you know, you're in pain to even do the basic components of your job. Because from what I'm reading the literature about this particular thing, some doctors look at it in the same way they look at fibromyalgia, which they think is in people's heads, you know,
right,
and they don't really have an answer for, and they don't know how to, you know, to address it. So the earlier you try to address that type of situation, the better. And I found that that's been helpful. But I would highly recommend anyone, you know, again, yeah, diet, routine, exercise, sleep. Man, sleep, at least know what your hours of sleep you need to be able to do, and make sure that you, if you have trouble sleeping, make sure you find a way to keep it uniform as much as, yeah, like, uniform as much as possible, because if you don't, then it's going to be harder for you to be able to sleep.
Yeah. All good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And you were an athlete. I know Ryan Riddle, friend of ours. I mean, he said he had more issues with nagging injuries writing at Bleacher Report than he did.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds weird, but like I've definitely had times like with my setup, I've got the dual screen thing so I can take notes. I know we're going to talk about that part of it too, but I do everything by hand, pen and paper. And there are times when I'll feel like the shoulders, I got a torn labrum in the right shoulder. I'll feel the pain there. And it's like, I've just been sitting here, but it's that repetitive motion part where you're like swinging the arm around. It does catch up with you. Getting old sucks, man. What can I say?
Yeah, it's weird. It is definitely weird. I'm like, I'm literally sitting in a recliner right now up to my desk with my feet up because I have one of those Herman Miller chairs, which is really nice, but because of my setup, apparently I can't use a mouse with it the way my table's set up right now without creating that issue. So I find that when I'm doing long-term film study and I'm working 16, 18 hour days, when I'm getting to doing that, sitting in an easy chair in a recliner seems to be the way to go. And I can put my mouse on one of the arms here and just kind of use it, and having an ergonomic mouse helps in that way. So I definitely recommend. And if anyone wants recommendations on ergonomic stuff, I would highly recommend Logitech's ergonomic mouses. There's one that's a vertical mouse that I tried at the Senior Bowl while I was down there last week, and that worked out great. And then there's one that you can that has a trackball so that you don't even have to move the mouse. You just use your thumb to move the trackball. And you have a button to make it really precise if you want to. And you can also angle the mouse in a way so it's in the natural position of how you use your hand. And both of those range from, I think, $70 to $90 at Best Buy. I know that those are rather pricey, but again, it sure beats a doctor bill. That's all I can say. And time off. So from that standpoint, let us move on to that idea that you just foreshadowed there, which is how you organize your information and resources when you're studying. And you study mostly quarterbacks and schemes. So let's look at it when you're evaluating a quarterback, like step by step. And it doesn't matter how much time it takes for you to share this. Just go in as much detail as you want to.
Yeah. And I mean, I think for me, the first thing I try to figure out when I'm studying a quarterback, whether, for somebody for the draft or even just, writing about a quarterback in the league, is I want to find out what their play caller calls. So whether it's, studying Joe Burrow, okay, well, you got Joe Brady and, he's their passing game coordinator. What have been the influences on him? What are the route concepts that he's sort of relied upon? So it's a lot of background research into the play caller, because then I have a better frame of reference for what he's being asked to do right now, and then what might be potential scheme fits for him down the road. And so, in the Burrow example, we could just keep using that. It's okay. So it's a lot of Sean Payton, West Coast influence stuff, a lot of quick game concepts, but you see how they work in some other shot type plays. And so you have a frame of reference. Okay, well, this is what Joe Burrow is being asked to do right now. And so that's usually step one. Now, step two, when I'm studying a quarterback is, every season I try to watch at least 4, if not 6 to 8 games on a passer. And I try to do that whether they're coming out or not. And so I've got that kind of tape on and that kind of games watched on Justin Herbert since he started at Oregon. So now I've got a baseline of almost, 24 games or so watched of Justin Herbert. And so that's a lot of obviously data that you can use, but it's a great way to sort of figure out how this player has developed, sort of track their development over the course of their time in college and get a real sense of who these guys are as quarterbacks. And so not everybody has to do it that way, but I'm lucky in the sense that where I have this focus on quarterbacks, I can really dive deep into these players. And so I try to watch a ton of, and in those, 4 to 6 games or so, I try to watch at least one game on the road, one game at home. I try to watch one game, if you can find it, in bad weather. because I want to get a sense for that. I want to watch, you know, one game against lower level competition because you want to see if players can sort of dominate lesser competition. And I want to watch games against upper level elite types of competition. And maybe, you know, for Joe Burrow, it's easy, you know, watch playoff games. But for Justin Herbert, like a Pac-12 championship game and things like that. Now, obviously, there can be some overlap. You might have a game where somebody's on the road in bad weather and it might check both of those boxes for you. But I want to see as much as I can the chances or the opportunities for these players to face moments that they'll face in the league. So that's another thing I try to focus on. And then when it comes down to sort of the micro level of how I do it, as I noted earlier, it's all pen and paper because I found that, you know, for different people, the learning process might be different. But for me, I'm much more likely to commit something to memory if I've written it down. And so that gives me the advantage. I just did a radio hit before hopping on here that I can somehow pull up out of memory a throw, an interception that Joe Burrow threw against Northwestern State because I've got to commit into memory based on writing it down. And I can tell you, you know, the flood route concept that he was running and the things that he's drawn just by writing it down. And so I write everything down. I always note, you know, the timestamp of the play, you know, down distance, which hash mark, game situation score, things like that for each snap. You know, then I try in the pre-snap phase, that's where a lot of the notes I take are actually, you know, learned and gleaned from because I try to put myself as much as I can into that quarterback's head before the ball is snapped. What is he seeing? What are his cues? What is he reading? What's the, you know, offensive formation, the personnel, the defensive formation and personnel, all that type of stuff. So then once the ball is snapped, I can get as close as I possibly can to that quarterback's frame of mind. And then that helps inform me for what he does on the given play. So say he sees a too high safety look and it gets rotated to a single high at the snap. And that seam route from the tight end that he thought was going to be there suddenly isn't because he's running it right at a middle of the field closed defender. Now, how does he reframe his focus and how does he handle that? And so that's sort of the process from big down to little, how I watch quarterbacks. It's lengthy. It takes a while. It might take me like 2 hours, two hours plus to get through a single game. And again, I'm lucky in that I just basically do that for quarterbacks. When I watch other positions for Patriots work or other stuff, you know, I'll be much more, you know, I'll work through it quicker. Still the sort of hand note process. But for quarterbacks, that's how I do it. I've found that it's worked. It helps me commit stuff to memory. And then I have that recall. So if I'm on a show or doing an article, I know, oh, yeah, there was that stick route that he failed to read it properly on when the number two receiver was covered by the slot corner pre-snap. Number three was uncovered. He's thinking he can throw that quick little stick to the number three, but slot corner jumps number three, and then he has a brain freeze, and he panics, and he gets sacked off the edge. Well, that was a play that Mitch Trubisky ran against Virginia his last year at UNC, and I still have it seared into my brain, also because he's still doing the same stuff now in his third year in the National Football League, but I got a little far afield there. I'm just saying, but that's how I do it. It's not for everybody, but I've found that it helps me. Maybe you can do that. Others that are listening, if you're studying players, quarterbacks, whatever, by taking notes, typing it out, whatever, but that's kind of the process I've used.
Well, you know, that's okay that you went far afield because I remember Mitchell Trubisky going far afield a couple of times back up in his own red zone, his own side of the 20 against Florida State and delivering some, getting sacked in a situation he should have thrown the ball away. So, you know, we remember those types of things. But that was excellent detail, you know, to share. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of similarities between what you and I do. I don't write it down on pencil and paper, but, you know, certainly when I get started analyzing a player, I use a database to track one set of information. I use an Excel spreadsheet. I use two different Excel spreadsheets to track two other forms of information. One is charting the player's, throws in terms of, you know, whether it's on script, off script, whether it's, under pressure or there's no pressure, where, you know, whether they're facing man or zone, and then also where he's attempting these passes, you know, what quadrant of the field. And I have several different quadrants that I use, and all of these different factors are combined in different ways to create, categories that I'm monitoring their accuracy, and I'm monitoring whether they're pinpoint or whether it's just catchable accuracy or they're completely inaccurate. with it. And so those are things I use for quarterbacks. For running backs, it's usually a spreadsheet of certain defined criteria as well as a database of defined criteria. And I may actually be going away from the database at some point within the next couple of years and just sticking to the spreadsheet form of the criteria that I use. But I used, you know, what I call depth of talent and breadth of talent. And I started out with breadth of talent, which was on the database, but I realized soon that I was just kind of evaluating who would get into the door for an interview as opposed to who were the best candidates that got right in the door. So I, you know, the spreadsheets have kind of evolved out of that in terms of the criteria that's on them. So, you know, I'm looking, all those things list what I've defined, you know, very clearly what I'm looking for. And then, you know, I used to write down everything that I saw, and it would take me 7 to 8 hours to watch a quarterback. And then at some point I realized that was overkill, and it was good for what I needed to do at the time when I started. But now I can usually watch a quarterback between, you know, usually between 1 hour and 2 hours and feel pretty good about what I got out of that. And a lot of it is that pre-snap, post-snap, and what you hone in on. And what I try to hone in on more than anything is the first, you know, is, you know, late in the pre-snap phase, what they've identified, what the defense has changed, like you highlighted with the two high to one high rotation as an example. And then also what I see post-snap, and try and oftentimes stop the tape with each step of the quarterback's drop, where I'm just looking to see where he's looking, how his where his body's turned towards, where he starts to change his position, and what's going on, you know, with the defense for him to make those changes, and try to look at and assess whether or not he made the quarterback turned his body away from a coverage that he shouldn't have. And maybe he should have waited a beat longer. Maybe he shouldn't have waited at all. Maybe he should have thrown the ball, you know, and making those types of judgments. So for me, it's that time, you know, late in the pre-snap phase, early in the post-snap phase, that I seem to get a lot out of in terms of how the quarterback processes the game. And so I'm, you know, there's a lot that I study with that. When it comes to other positions, it's kind of the same thing as like with running backs. It's what they see pre-snap, and are they, you know, what should they be looking at? And because I may not know whether they actually are, but you'll often see examples of them being able to do, you know, that there's a good logic that they probably did see the same things, but like, you know, where the linebackers are playing, does the safety creep up? Is there a cornerback that's tightening his position as if he's going to work towards the edge of the line of scrimmage there? Is, you know, did the defensive line shift? And then, you know, looking at what the running back ran, and then maybe going back and looking at those changes to see how those changes match up with what the offense was trying to run there. I'll look at things like very early on when the running back's heading towards the quarterback to take the exchange. Are his eyes up, and is he assessing what the defense is doing? What keys are he looking at as he steps towards that exchange point? And is he able to spot any type of penetration or any change that's going to force him to make a dramatic move that may veer away from the overall concept of the play? You know, at the same time, too, as he begins to take steps into the crease, you know, he's diagnosing from the time he, you know, before the snap to when he takes the exchange. And then he's acting, if you ask me, from the exchange point to working to the line. And at that point, it's usually, if he's not taking evasive measures right away, then that means he has time to be able to manipulate the defense as he works towards the line. So I'm looking at what's he doing, what is he doing to manipulate the defense or to follow the rushing scheme, if the running scheme, if there's not a lot of manipulation required. And so I look at things like that for the runner, you know, obviously for receivers and tight ends, you know, and if we're talking about blocking, you know, that's a whole other issue. But again, oftentimes I will get as granular as I'm taking, you know, I'm clicking and slowing down steps at a time at specific phases of the play, you know. So for receivers, if they're playing tight man, it's the release oftentimes, and often how they're gauging what the coverage is doing early pre, you know, late pre, early post snap. You know, that's a portion of it. Same thing when it comes to, you know, with tight ends blocking, you know, are they the first off the ball? Are they in the position they need to get into? How do they use their hands? Are they rolling through their hips? You know, you're looking at granular level detail and trying to find those details so that I can, you know, have an idea of what to look for and, you know, and keep those things in kind of a written checklist format so that I don't have to keep track of it all on a mental level. So, you know, I just kind of touched on a little bit of, you know, a system for doing this. But, you know, do you have a system of what you follow when you're studying players, Mark?
Yeah. And, you know, I touched on it as well and sort of the process I go through. The other thing that I'll sort of mention in sort of the system is I tend to have my own sort of cross-check process. I won't read what other people have put together, whether it's a scouting report or Twitter threads or anything. I won't read any of that until I've done most of my work on a player.
Me too.
And then I'll read it. You know, so, you know, for example, take quarterbacks, take, you know, what stuff Matt has done on Tua Tagovailoa. You know, I'll do my work on Tua and then I'll have my notes. And, you know, another thing I mentioned that I do it all by pen and paper. Then I put all that stuff into a binder. It gets sorted, tabbed by quarterback. And at the start of each section on a QB, I have this little sheet that I print out and it's just fill in the blank stuff, you know, the quarterback, school he played for, the games that I watch, and then, you know, big box for his strengths and then weaknesses and then stuff on areas he needs to improve, scheme, thoughts, and then it ends with some biographical information. And that's also something that I just basically pull out of my notes to then fill in. It's just a little cover sheet type thing that I use. But once that's done and put together, then I'll read like what Matt has done on Tua or what Matt has done on Burrow. And then I'll see if my thoughts more or less track or don't. And if they don't, I'll note those areas. And sometimes it sends me back to the film. Sometimes it doesn't. But it makes me know that, okay, I feel like this quarterback does X, Y, and Z good or well enough to play in the National Football League. Others don't. Did I really see that right or not? And I'll go back and look at my notes and I feel like I have to look at some plays or even full games again. I'll do that. It won't change my opinions for the most part, but it'll either make me sort of reevaluate what I've seen on film or just rethink things, or on a bare minimum, anticipate some questions and arguments I might get when I'm on shows or doing hits or talking to Matt about QBs, because maybe that's the old lawyer in me, but it's a way to sort of bolster my body of thinking on a player and prepare for being asked like, well, Joe Burrow doesn't have a great arm. You know, do you have reservations about him? It's like, well, yeah, I do, but here's why. Or to a, you know, you say he's not best suited for a downfield passing scheme. Why is that? Well, here are my reasons why. And so, you know, maybe it's parts of my old history of trial preparation, but that's kind of how I do a cross-checking process.
Like it. Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I think that, you know, for me, I mean, I talked about, you know, how I define everything in writing and then kind of weigh it and with a point value. And then I, you know, and then I answer whether he did it or didn't do it. And then I also stack, rank, and tier people. And these are all things that you see in the RSP in terms of the detail that goes into having a system for scoring and grading. And certainly for me, I mean, there are times that, you know, we can't avoid what other people say and what they think, you know, and sometimes there'll be points where something just is jarring to me on a level that's so like not expected that I'm looking at it and going, I didn't expect that. Or I see something that I'm kind of questioning. I might ask you, or I might ask somebody else and go, hey, what do you think of this? You know, I'm seeing this about someone. Have you watched them yet? You know, and occasionally it'll be like a very specific detail, you know, on one level or another. But overall, yeah, I try to ignore what other people have to say until I finished up most of my work. And then, you know, then I may go look a little bit here or there if something just doesn't, if I'm still just not feeling good about my evaluation. Like it, there's just some things that I felt like I could score either way and I'm not sure about, and I want to know what other people think about it. And just to see if, you know, I'm the only one on this other planet or whether they're, right. they're on it as well. And so then I'll look at that point. And if I need to go back and rewatch, you know, for those specific things, that's what I do. And I often take notes where I'll have notes that, that'll say things like, haven't seen, you know, for a running back, maybe I haven't seen him stand up, block a defensive tackle yet. And I'm waiting for the opportunity to see him do that. Can he at least get in the guy's way? Is he going to try and punch? Is he going to try and, you know, drop his head into the guy, you know, all the different things like that. Or I haven't seen a running back, you know, run an intermediate route or deeper and be able to track the ball over his head, even though I've seen him do a number of different things that are impressive as a receiver. I'll note those types of details so that when I'm done with watching, you know, maybe I've watched 8, 9, 12, 15 games, you know, or if I'm watching a smaller school guy, I don't have access to his tape, a lot of his tape, and I've only seen 3 or 4 of his games. You know, what I will try to do after that point is I'll go back and find any type of source of game that I can see, whether it's a complete game and I have those on tape, or whether it's even highlights. And I'll look through highlights, especially when I'm done, because if there's something I haven't seen that I need to be, you know, as a positive that I need to see, well, it's going to show up on a highlight, you know, so more times than not. So that's a good time to be able to watch a highlight, because that's supposed to be the player at his best. And so you'll often see a lot of the things that you highlight that you liked in those highlights, but you might find some plays that you didn't. That you didn't have access to because other games, you know, weren't cut up, or you didn't get the broadcast of it. And it'll show you something that you needed to see, maybe even a couple of times. So that I find helpful to do later on as well, in terms of being able to watch them. Oftentimes before I write the RSB and finish or write up the scouting profiles that I do, and I've just finished finalizing my rankings, or have come very close to finalizing my rankings, I'll go player by player and literally watch their highlights, like find the best highlights I can find and go through it and see, is there anything there that counters what I'm looking for? And usually make a little checklist of things that says, these are things I haven't seen. These are things that I need to see. And then sometimes I'll see something that sticks out that's just very clear to me, that's like, I said he couldn't do this, and it looks like he can. Like, I've seen it like 3 times now, and let me go back and look at the things that let me go back and look at the scenarios where I said he couldn't do it, compare it to the scenarios that he did, and see if I can reconcile that on some level. Because usually at that point, you can get very specific and say, okay, yes, he does track the ball. He can take contact while catching the football when his back's to the defender, but when he's running down the field and on a route angling towards a defender, he tends to lose concentration and drops the ball in the face of contact. And that's a very specific point, as opposed to saying he can't catch the ball versus contact. You know, so things like that will happen. Or, you know, the quarterback, you know, when he's confused about the coverage, or, you know, he doesn't have a decisive moment, he tends to slow his release, you know, down, and there tends to be a pause at the top of his release pattern, something of that nature. That's some of that stuff. So let's just end this with, you know, something just kind of fun, or talk about the grind a little bit here. When you hear the phrase, the grind, I mean, what does that mean to you? And what might be lost on others when you hear that? Because you'll hear people make jokes about it on Twitter a lot now, or they'll take it very seriously and say, you know, I'm grinding away. So,
yeah, I mean, a lot of times, like in sort of the realm of the work that I do, people talk about the phrase grinding the tape. You know, Kyle Krabs has that as his Twitter handle. And, you know, there is certainly enjoyment to be found in sitting down and watching football to the, you know, minute detail that we tend to do. And there's joy in, say, you get an assignment to write a piece about, you know, how the 49ers defense is going to get after Aaron Rodgers, which is something I did just a couple weeks ago. And you get a chance to sort of break down what Robert Saleh has done defensively, and you see some cool conceptual stuff. And, you know, part of the joy that I find in doing what I do is finding little bits like that, writing about them, and then seeing them show up in the game that Sunday. Like, that's always cool to me. So there is some joy in the grind, but there's also like a dual track negative aspect to it. One, that might mean you watch a lot of bad football. And I know to the most, you know, the large majority of listeners out there, people listening to this or people that follow us, and we talked about this in the last show, that would love to do what we do, but maybe don't get the chance to do it. You know, one of the drawbacks is you do end up watching a lot of bad football. And there can be some moments where you're like, it's Tuesday morning, I just dropped the kids off to school, and now I have to watch and break down Mitchell Trubisky. And that can be that can wear on you. I kid you not. And so that's an aspect to it. And the other aspect of the grind is the fact that there will always be those moments. And I talked about this in the last show where you feel like you're not the smartest person doing this, and you will like watch film for hours and you just, it's not clicking for you, or you finally see something, you go on Twitter and 15 other people have already written articles about it, or there are concepts that you just can't figure out. At All 22 Bets on Twitter, he and I and some others were talking on a thread the other day about sort of some of this stuff, like the note-taking process and things like that. And he had a joke where, you know, my notes are just 43 bullet points of, is this duo, question mark? Because there are scheme-type stuff that, as much as we study this game and learn about this game and as much as we know about this game, we still won't figure out. And so there will be those moments that will humble you when you're like, I can't do it. I don't know what I'm seeing. These people are all smarter than me. Or you walk into Lad Peebles and you look around and everybody around you that you're talking to is smarter than you and you know it. Like, there are those moments where the grind can be a bit negative, but the good outweighs the bad. You know, for as difficult as this can be at times, the good outweighs the bad. And so the grind, it has some great moments. It'll have some negative moments. It'll have some moments, you know, where you question yourself and what you're seeing. And it has some moments where you're watching bad football. But like sort of, you know, some people said about, you know, a good day on the golf course is better than a day in the office. A bad day watching football is better than a good day in the office for me.
Right. There you go. Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, I mean, I think – you know, I mean, listen, the past 2 days I've gone through probably, you know, 8 or 9 running backs where I've watched, you know, 7 or 8 games and of each of them. I mean, I remember watching, you know, 2 days ago in the middle of the night, watching LaMichael Perine and watching 7 of his games because I was looking for 2 specific things that I hadn't seen consistently enough in the other games that I'd already watched. You know, and so it's like you're investigating something and you're going through all the work that is, you know, pretty unglamorous, you know, and you've already seen LaMichael Perine enough to know he's going to do this in this situation. Yep. He did it. You know, for the 17th time I've seen him do this, you know, good or bad, you know, I'm waiting for this. I'm looking for these things that he hasn't done yet. And I still may not see it. You know, going through that. And, you know, there's things like that. And then there's just the whole idea of, you know, you do all that research and that may be the fun part. And then it's time to write it up. And you have to, you know, you have to do that. And you're tired, you know, and it's late and you're ready to end your shift. And you got things that you have to do and get those types of things done. Or it's about just putting out regular content. You know,
yeah.
And I think that sometimes that's the big deal is putting out that regular content on a basis that people know you're active, that you're reliable in terms of the work that you're doing, that you're going to get done on a deadline, that you're flexible with other people to an extent when you need to be able to do a show. You know, I mean, I just did Ross Tucker's show and he had to do it out of a car in Miami because of the, you know, and he just said, long story, but you know, I know we said 11:30. Can you do 9:30? And I'm like, or 12. And I'm like, I can do either time. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, it's like, looks like it's going to be closer to 9:45. I'm sorry. Right. It's like, yeah, I know, you know, those things happen. It's all right. You know, but you, being reliable is a big deal in this industry, is being reliable, being able to work to deadline and be able to do quality work with every assignment and doing what you say you're going to do. And it amazes me that, you know, I'll deal with people who who are like, they're like amazed that you're on time all the time, or that you are there where you need to be, or at least you communicate with them when you're not. Or that you turn in work as you say you're going to turn it in. And it's, you know, apparently that's not always a consistent thing. And I can understand, you know, if you're part-time and this is something that's just fun for you to do and you're just trying, and this is kind of like your hobby, then I get that if you can't do something on a regular basis that, you know, that's not your priority. But if you're trying to make this your real gig, if you're trying to really make stand out and do and have people recognize you for the work you do, then, you know, you've got to put out work regularly, and it's got to be in a format where it can be used in an evergreen or as potentially evergreen content. Even if it's not evergreen content, you've got to think of it with that level of ambition, that it may be the case, because just tweeting stuff out, you know, that's fine. But, you know, and certainly Twitter videos are getting a lot of, you know, getting a lot of attention. But if you're not being a good employee for the people you work for, and you're not being reliable for them, then they're just going to think it's all about you. You know, right. They're going to think that all you're about is getting your following up or making deals for yourself, as opposed to being a team player. So you have to understand how to be a team player for the sites that you work for, and, you know, trying to work with their priority. If that's what you're really trying to work towards, is to, you know, have a career in that, from that aspect. So let's just kind of end this on, you know, a little bit more from a couple of Super Bowl questions then, and we'll go from there. But I just wondered if you had to live through one of these in terms of bad Super Bowl beats, you know, you can choose one of your own if you want, but here's the ones from the list that I think were pretty rough. You know, being Walter Payton and watching the fridge score, even though that was not necessarily a bad beat, but to be basically the one man gang of that team from the 70s to the early 80s and finally get to the Super Bowl and not get a chance to punch one in you know, when the big boy got that shot, that sounds kind of rough. Or maybe being one of Steve McNair, Kevin Dyson being 1 yard shy, or the Falcons defense with that massive lead. And would you want to be a Falcons defender with that massive lead? Now you know what you're going to find out with New England, you know, being able to come back from that, you know, make that horrific, you know, the historic comeback or horrific comeback if you're a Falcons fan.
These are all, you know, really good choices. And, you know, I was thinking about this a lot, and I was going to go with, you know, that first one, Walter Payton, because, you know, at least you still win a Super Bowl, right? But, I mean, I wanted to go somewhere different with this. And so I'm going with Sam Wyche, Super Bowl 23. You know, ooh, you're going up against your mentor. You have that, you know, dagger of an ending when Montana hits John Taylor for a touchdown. And I still remember the NFL Films video after that of him looking up at the scoreboard, 39 seconds, and he just says to himself, 39 seconds. We were 39 seconds away. But more than anything, I remember that moment after the game where, you know, he meets Bill Walsh at midfield. You know, they tell each other they love him. They walk off the field arm in arm, and, you know, Sam Wyche is being like, man, that was just one heck of a game, wasn't it? That was just one heck of a game. And it sort of, you know, reminded me that when I was thinking about it, that there's so much more than just a game, you know? And to see a guy have just a crushing defeat, but also in that moment, happy for somebody that was his mentor and happy for somebody that was in some way responsible for him being in that position to begin with, you know, it's really sort of a touching moment. And so I think that would be my pick. I'd be Sam Wyche. I'd lose a Super Bowl with 39 seconds left. I'd have to see Montana and Rice carve me up, but I'd get to walk off the field with my mentor who had just defeated me, knowing that, look, there are bigger things in life than this.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. And that's great perspective. You know, I would probably say I'd probably pick the McNair to Dyson, because after what McNair did pretty much all the way through that drive, he pretty much gave his all on that play. Yeah. And I think that that was one of those situations where, you know, you can walk off the field with your head up in that situation where like you left it all out on the field. So that would probably be the one that I would have picked. So do you have any, do you do Super Bowl festivities or not?
Yeah, I really don't. And this is going to sound so obnoxious, but covering the Patriots as I have been for the past couple of seasons, like I've had to work, you know, you know, the game ends and I do a show. And I'll tell you this story. We were at a Super Bowl party last year. We had some friends that had a Super Bowl party. We said, look, they're, you know, our kids are friends and stuff like that. We can go for the first half. We'll leave at halftime so we can get the kids to bed. And I'm mingling with everybody and we're talking before the game. The game starts. I sit right in front of the TV with my pen and my paper and I'm taking notes on every play. And I just look like a freak. And I could hear people murmur, and then somebody finally asks, are you just taking notes? I'm like, oh, you know, this is – I have to do a show when the game ends. And everyone's like, oh, blah. But I look like an idiot. And so, you know, I've had to basically work for the past couple of Super Bowls, including a Super Bowl that they lost to the Eagles where I had to go upstairs and do an episode and do a podcast where your team had just lost the Super Bowl. So this year's, you know, again, I know about how obnoxious I sound right now. But, you know, the Patriots aren't playing. But we'll probably just have, you know, snacks and stuff for the kids. We'll put it up on the big screen and let the kids stay up a little bit later than usual. My son will probably troll me multiple times as he has this entire season about, you know, Tom Brady not being in it. I mean, he said this to me, Matt, and I don't know if I've told this story on the show before, but the Sunday after the Patriots lost to the Titans, we were out. We had gone to church. We were at brunch with the family. And he's like, you know, Dad, what was your favorite pick six Tom Brady threw? Was it the one to end the Titans game or the one to end the Dolphins game? And this is an 8-year old. And I'm just like, man, you're already dunking on me now.
Who does he like?
Well, I'll tell you this. A couple of years ago, you know who we went as for on Halloween? Carson Wentz. And what did he get for Christmas from Grammy, my mom and my dad? What did they buy him because he wanted it?
A green gurney?
No, a Lamar Jackson shirt. Yeah, he's now – and my father, who, strangely enough, similar to me, after he retired, he now has a second career as an artist. My son asked for a drawing of Lamar Jackson. My dad did a fantastic drawing of Lamar. He framed it for him. My son loves it. But, yeah, like two quarterbacks that have really sort of throttled the Patriots, or at least in a sense Carson Wentz, the Eagles did. He wasn't playing for it. But, yeah, guys that have beaten Tom Brady. Those are the teams that, and those are the quarterbacks that my son seems to like. So yeah, I'm in for next, you know, 10 great years with this one. And don't even get me started on my daughter. Believe me. Oh my gosh.
Well, the last time I watched a meaningful football game with my daughter, she was a Panthers fan, and we watched the Panthers beat the Seahawks. In the championship game where Russell Wilson nearly brought them back, but they had a horrific start. And she was rooting for the Panthers. I was rooting for the Seahawks. So that was the last time I've done that. And then probably, you know, but I don't do any Super Bowl festivities either. I may watch the game just to watch the game. But it's usually during a busy season. So and I'm so kind of tuned up for what I'm so obsessed with what I'm trying to watch right now that I know the game's good and I'll watch it. And I usually take the time off to watch it as it's going on, but sometimes I'll just tape it and I'll watch it later. And I won't even pay attention to anything that's going on Twitter and just kind of watch it on my own time. But it depends. I would say that I'm certainly not like you. It's kind of like, you don't want to watch this game with me. I mean, it's like, you know, and it was funny because Cecil Lammy and I, you know, we traveled down to the Senior Bowl and people would be like, oh, I'd love to watch a game with you guys. We came up, you know, he had gotten up at 4 a.m. to come over here, to fly over to Atlanta so that we could drive to Mobile. We go up to my office to watch the AFC and NFC championship game. Both of us nearly fell asleep. Both of us were like fighting sleep because it was like, you know, it's different when you're actively trying to analyze what's going on and do the work. And then also you've been working hard and he's been traveling a lot and doing different things. And I've been working a lot around the clock and trying to change my schedule so that I could go to Mobile. And, you know, I'm laughing because he's like in the chair I'm sitting in right now with, you know, kicking back. And I'm literally like sitting on the floor, like on a, you know, leaned up against some pillows with my feet up on this like kind of ottoman thing that I have. And both of us, I think both of us got caught the other snoring at one point where we were like, where we missed stuff. And then like, it, you know, it's just kind of funny how that is. So it's much less glamorous than it seems, I think, for a lot of people when it comes to kind of stuff that we do. So
right.
One thing that we do appreciate is all of you listening to this show, and certainly, you know, follow Mark Schofield at Mark Schofield on Twitter. Find me at Matt Waldman on Twitter. And of course, the Rookie Scouting Portfolio is available for pre-sale at mattwaldmanrsp.com. For $21.95, you get a pre-draft, you get a post-draft. Both of those are great for dynasty and redraft formats, especially when you're looking for those late round guys or guys off the free agent wire and redraft or DFS, where you can get, you know, nice deals from people who are kind of less heard of, you know, at the moment, but from, you know, the average football fan, you're going to know about these guys way ahead of time. And then you get a monthly newsletter that comes out that updates rankings and talks about some of the players that will be coming up, you know, that I'll be looking at in the future, as well as, you know, profiling players and how they're performing, you know, over the first, you know, 2 to 3 years of their career. That comes out from June through December. All of that's for $21.95. And a percentage of that goes to Darkness to Light as a donation, you know, to help them prevent sexual abuse of children. Appreciate all the feedback that you guys have given towards the RSP. And if you haven't tried it out yet, I would certainly recommend checking out mattwaldmanrsp.com, where there's some video tours. You'll be blown away by the depth of detail that's there. All right, guys, thanks. And we will talk with you again, or give you a chance to listen to us talk next week.